Good evening. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. I hope that you are learning and becoming very upset over the information that you're hearing. I also hope that you're not taking my word for any of this. I hope and I pray sincerely that you are taking the references to the materials that I am giving you, that you are finding, discovering the sources of these documents, that you are indeed confirming that these documents are exactly what I am reading to you, are disclosing to you over the airwaves. If you don't, then you are doing the same thing to me that you've done to all of the people that you've sent to Washington and trusted through all the years, that they would take good care of you, and don't do that. You see, unless you take this information, the sources that we give you, obtain the documents and check them for yourselves, then you will never know if I am just another person in a long chain of traitors who is once again lying to you. I can assure you that I am not, but you must assure yourself of that. You can never trust anyone again. This is the age of deception. That's how we got to this point in time, is by trusting people. Oh, this is America. It couldn't happen here. Why, we sent old Joe to Congress, and old Joe's going to take care of us. Well, I think you've been discovering that old Joe wasn't taking care of anybody but himself. We have a government full of traitors. There's no doubt about it. If you can listen to all this information, if you can go out and discover that the documents that I've given you and sourced to you are true, and that what I've been revealing to you is, in fact, the truth, there is no other explanation than Washington, D.C. is full of traitors. Your state capital is full of traitors. Most probably your county government is full of traitors, and maybe even your city government, especially if you're living in a large city. But that doesn't mean that just because you may be living in a rural area that you're immune from traitors. You would be amazed, ladies and gentlemen. So, I believe that we may be able to finish this particular series up tomorrow night and be able to take phone calls during the latter half of the program tomorrow night. And then, of course, we will go into another series in order that you may become more illumined, so to speak. I hope you have pen and paper by your side, ladies and gentlemen, and prepared to take copious notes. You need to do that. And don't forget, don't take my word for anything. Research it. Listen to everyone. Read everything. Believe absolutely nothing unless you can confirm it or prove it in your own research. If you're not willing to do the research, then you're just another puppet on the end of somebody's string. And whenever they pull that string, you're going to dance just like all the other little sheeple puppets out there. Is that what you want to be? Somehow I don't think so. Unless you haven't got a brain in your head, and unless you aren't worth saving, I don't think so.
See, most of you have never heard these things before, never knew them. I know that most of you can read, but you never looked. You've never bothered to find out. It's amazing that the things we pretend to care most about, we know nothing about, don't even make the slightest effort to find out about. That bothers me a lot, an awful lot. He says, quote, I have offered this resolution to repeal the Second Amendment very seriously, unquote. And he goes on, and the need to control the sale, manufacture, and distribution of guns in our society. Polls have clearly shown that 75 to 85% of the people want some form of gun control, but we do not have gun control, except to a very limited extent. That's not true, folks. 85% of the people do not want gun control. That is a lie. but one might be tempted to think that if one were to read the papers every day and listen to the news on television and watch the silly, stupid lies. You see, there is no poll that has ever shown that 85% of the people want some form of gun control. This man is a consummate liar. And for those of you listening in New York, he represents you. Doesn't that bother you? He lies about this, he'll lie about everything. The truth is, all socialists lie continuously all the time. That's the only way they can win, folks. On that, Rush Limbaugh is absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. He called that shot absolutely, perfectly, 100% right. Socialists are consummate, perpetual, habitual liars. And he says, but we do not have gun control, except to a very limited extent, because a small group of intense gun fanatics, listen to this, a small group of intense gun fanatics have perverted the democratic process through threats and intimidation of any public figure who dares to speak for and vote for what the overwhelming majority of the people want, Mr. Owens. Mr. Owens, you wouldn't know the truth if it hit you in the face. I say it again, you're a liar. You're scum. You should never have been allowed to represent anyone. I doubt if most of the people you represent even know that you are twisting the truth and perpetrating these fantasies. Listen to this. A small group of intense gun fanatics, people who care about this country, care about maintaining our freedoms, are now gun fanatics. Do you know that patriotism has become a dirty word now? Simply because of the slant that patriotic rallies and patriotism and patriots have been portrayed with in the news media? Most people are afraid to say, I am a patriot. Scared to death, in fact. It has become politically incorrect because of idiots like Mr. Owens. Idiots. Mr. Owens, I publicly invite you to appear on this broadcast, The Hour of the Time, and debate me face to face. I don't think you have the guts. I'd say something else, but we might have some women listening out there. I don't think you have what it takes. I think you're a sniveling little lying coward, and I issue this challenge, and I will send you a copy of the broadcast of this program. And I will, of course, reveal your reply to the American people over this broadcast and to the people of the world, because you are exactly what I say you are. You will not appear here with facts and figures. You will appear with lies if you have the guts to appear, and I know already that you don't, because I will have the facts and figures and the truth to confront you with, and your lies will not stand up for 10 seconds flat. This is a worldwide broadcast, Mr. Owens, and I do not issue this challenge frivolously. I will literally put you out of the running of any future political aspirations that you ever have if you dare to appear on this program. And we will make hundreds of copies of the tapes and distribute them in your district all over the state of New York so that your constituents can hear what a silly fool they've placed in Congress. Also, Mr. Owens, a non-response will be considered total abject surrender. He says here, the Second Amendment is unnecessary in 1992. Why 1992, folks? Why not 1981? Why not 2001? Why not in 1872? Why, ladies and gentlemen, has the world changed? Has the nature of man changed? Is the world at peace? We have no enemies. No one would want to do away with us. But according to Mr. Owens, the Second Amendment is unnecessary in 1992. The purpose of the Second Amendment is to assure the people's right to bear arms in a well-regulated militia. Nobody would dream of interfering with the use of guns by the National Guard, the Armed Forces Reserves, which is our well-regulated militia. Mr. Owens, again, you are a liar. That's not true. It is, in fact, a blatant lie. The United States Senate has ruled that no branch of the military consists or makes up what is known as the militia. The United States Senate has ruled that the National Guard is not the militia. The United States Senate passed a resolution, which I will read on the air in the coming days, which quite simply states that the militia is made up of the whole people. The whole people. You see, you should consult your colleagues before you make stupid statements like this. And of course, it is stupid because you're closer to the source of it than I am. How come I know this and you don't, Mr. Owens? You're supposed to be representing us. And yet me, way out here in Arizona, far, far from the center of government, knows the law better than you do. And I would venture to say I probably know the law better than most of those who pretend to represent us. He goes on to say, listen to this, folks. Oh, boy. Here he just throws his whole argument right out the window. He says, and I quote, "And the right of that kind of well-regulated militia is protected and understood without this amendment being in place." Certainly is, because the law protects it. The law protects it because that amendment is in place. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. What's more amazing is that you people in New York sent this blithering idiot to represent you, and you don't even know what he's doing in Congress. I guarantee that most, if not all of you listening from the state of New York, never even knew that this man was doing this in Congress, making these asinine statements, and furthermore, I doubt if you even knew that this man had introduced a resolution to repeal the second article and amendment to the United States Constitution, which is the only thing in this entire world that has kept Americans free and will keep Americans free. And the moment that that right is gone and guns are taken away, and I don't care how many laws you pass, you will not take the guns away from the majority of the American people. I can assure you, you might take some bullets away in a dead body to the morgue, but you will not take the guns out of the hands of the majority of the American people, Mr. Owens. I can't understand, with all the socialist countries existing in this world, where these people could go and live in a government, in a repressive society that they love and enjoy, why they don't do it. Why are they hell-bent on destroying this country? Why are they hell-bent on taking the freedoms away from Americans? Mr. Owens, I'm sure that with your great, wonderful talent for socialist propaganda, that Mr. Castro would welcome you into his government, and probably would give you a raise. Yes, he would probably give you a raise. You'd probably get 2 loaves of bread a month instead of one. And I would love to see you go. In fact, Mr. Owens, I will pay your way. I will pay your way first class by any conveyance you so desire. I don't care if I have to work the rest of my life to pay for it. I will pay for it. If you love socialism so much, if you want to be in a place where the people have no freedoms, if you want to be somewhere where no one can own weapons, I, Mr. Owens, will happily, me all by myself, will pay your way by whatever convenience or conveyance, first-class passage with all the amenities and any extras that you want to spend, even if I have to work the rest of my life to do it, to any socialist nation on the face of this earth that you wish to move to and live in. And I mean that, folks. I don't say anything unless I mean it. I will do it if Mr. Owens takes me up on it, which he won't. You see, all of these socialists really love living here in the freedom that we have. They don't even understand what they're really helping to bring about. And when they do, they will be the first to cry and whimper and beg for the rest of them to save them and restore their freedoms, because that's what they've always done throughout history.
I love it. Actually, I don't. Actually, I really don't. But sometimes it makes me laugh. And sometimes, folks, it makes me cry, to tell you the truth.
He says here, so I would hope that those members who are interested and have gotten the information will join me in offering this resolution to repeal the Second Amendment. I hope also we will take whatever steps are necessary long before the Second Amendment finds its way onto the floor of Congress to end the savage and barbaric proliferation of guns in our society.
Oh, boy. Then he introduces a newspaper article.
And it says, if nothing else, says Owens, perhaps his resolution will start a useful discussion about the urgent need for stronger gun control laws. Down here he says, most nations that are industrialized do have tight control over the manufacture, sale, and distribution of guns.
That's correct, folks. Wherever they have that, the people have almost no freedoms.
How many of you really believe that the people who live in Great Britain are free? I've been there. Many other people have been there. Some of the listeners of this program live there. Some of them are English citizens. Some of them are American citizens who live in England. Some of them are from other countries who live in England. I can tell you from my experience, talking to the English people on their own soil, they do not like the government under which they live. Complete, utter British socialism. It sucks just like socialism sucks everywhere else in the world, and the people are not happy. They are not happy. If you don't believe it, you just get your little button gear and hop on a plane, fly right over there, and you'll find out. Talk to someone who lives there. We just had visitors here. Marcus McLean. Our friend Haley Mills was just here, stayed with us several days. If you know who these people are, you know that they're English citizens. You know, she works very hard. She's a very good actress. One of the best, in fact. And she makes good money. And you know what happens to most of the money she makes because she lives in England? Most of it is taken away by the government in taxes. Do you know that they even have a tax bracket in England where you could be required to pay 110% of your income in taxes? Did you know that anybody is used to making the kind of money that the upper middle class makes in this country? Are taxed 75-80% of what they make? Were you aware of this? And this is what you want for the United States of America? This Mr. Owens wants to live under socialism, where the government would take most of what he makes in taxes so that socialism could give him back all the benefits that he could have purchased with that money. And he is one of those congressmen who voted for this huge pay raises that they've been voting themselves in recent years. Now, how do they rectify this in their minds? If they want socialism, if they want total, complete government, which controls everything, administers everything, takes care of everything, ensures that you have clothing and a job and everything else, how can they rectify this great question, this dichotomy? They want this. They know they're not going to have any money, yet they keep voting themselves pay raise as if they're addicted to money. Socialists have never made sense in the history of the world, ladies and gentlemen. And I don't think they're about to start now. Do you?
This is the coalition, the man coalition. I ain't a politician, but I've got views. Some folks want to ban cars. Some want to get rid of Fender guitars. Why don't you do your thing? Damn coalition, they are after you and me. They want to get Coalition. Japan Coalition. The views of a musician. Yeah, I've got some. Some folks want to ban cars. Some want to get rid of electric guitars. Why can't everybody else leave everybody else alone? Now the latest thing they want to stamp out is violence on TV. And the worst of all is that Oscar-winning rap.
Go, Carolyn, go.
Farewell, Foghorn Leghorn. So long, Yosemite Sam. They're messing with our heroes, and we got to stop them now. And this is the Coalition, the Band Coalition. I ain't a politician, but I've got views. Some folks want to ban cars. Some want to get rid of Fender guitars. Why don't you do your thing, and we'll do our thing, too. This is the Coalition, the Band Coalition. The views of a musician, yeah, I've got some. Some folks want to ban cars. Get rid of electric guitars. Why can't everybody else leave everybody else alone?
Yeah, you do your thing and we'll do ours. You ought to see Carolyn dancing around this studio. It's incredible. Here we go, folks. These are remarks of the Honorable Lawrence H. Smith of Wisconsin in the House of Representatives, Wednesday, May 4th, 1955. Mr. Smith of Wisconsin, Mr. Speaker, there are people in our country today who would surrender our national sovereignty to a fictitious form of world government. That's the first sentence. Just to pique your interest, from the Congressional Record Appendix. Congressional Record Appendix, May 4th, 1955. Page A3016. Under leave to extend my remarks, I am including an article that appears in the current issue of the American Legion magazine by Zane B. Thurston, What You Should Know About World Government. At its National Convention, 1951, National Convention, the American Legion adopted a resolution which said in part, "We reiterate our opposition to the participation of the United States in any form of world federation, world government, or in any intermediate federative organization which would in whole or in part involve the sacrifice of sovereignty of the United States." The Legion again amplified this strong opposition in a resolution at its 1954 National Convention. In so doing, the Legion has rendered a great service to our constitutional republic by calling our attention to the inherent dangers of the world government notion. It is well to establish at the outset that an idealistic and nebulous abstraction hovering in the minds of intellectual daydreamers, it is very real, it is high-powered, and it is a liberally financed movement, supported by many groups here and abroad, dedicated to the task of creating a federal union of the world. My personal interest in the world government idea, over and above the prompting of my natural religious and patriotic instincts, stems from the fact that one of its main protagonists is a fellow townsman. Indeed, much of the spade work which has been done in this country was done less than 2 miles from my home at the so-called Dublin Conference in early 1945. 1945. Did you hear that, folks? 1945. The climax of the work at these conferences and since will be the attempt by the United World Federalists Incorporated, one of the most powerful groups pressing for world government in this country, to expedite their plan of transforming the United Nations into a world government when its charter comes up for amendments in July of this year. It is not my purpose to analyze, criticize the many specifications, requirements, provisions, and restrictions of the various world government schemes which the American Legion obviously considers to be inimical to the continued sovereignty and independence of our constitutional republic. Rather, I shall dwell upon those inherent contradictions, fake promises, and ridiculous notions that render the theory of world government operable and impracticable in itself. The avowed supreme goal of world government advocates is the creation of a federal government embracing all the nations of the world. This they consider to be the only conceivable way to establish and preserve world peace. Extremely vocal prior to and during the World War II and in the late 40s, they found expression in such organizations as Federal Union Incorporated, the Atlantic Union Committee, the United World Federalists Incorporated, and various other lesser groups. Before any valid argument can be made against the theory, the best possible case for the opposition must be fairly and objectively established and can best be accomplished by quoting directly from their literature, speeches, and public pronouncements. Folks, that's always the best way because they always lie and they always have their facts wrong and they always tinker with statistics. For instance, in the total of number of people killed by handguns in the United States are criminals killed by police officers in the performance of their duties. Last night, when I read to you the speech of Mr. Owens from New York proposing a resolution to repeal the second article and amendment to the Constitution, we talked about a boy who had stolen a handgun and it killed a bunch of people. Well, what Mr. Owens didn't tell you folks is that the father of that boy was a police officer, and the handgun that he stole was his father's service revolver. Chihuahua. I think I'll go to Mexico, too. Oh, sometimes this is so hilarious, I just can't stand it. Oh, boy. I wonder if... Well, never mind. It's amazing. I continue. A brochure entitled, Let's Not Make the Same Mistake Twice, published by Federal Union Incorporated, very aptly states their reason for existence and can be fairly presented as representing the motivations of all world government agitators, even though not all would subscribe to the Federal Union plan. The brochure, in effect, says, quote, in fact, it says verbatim, quote, after the war will come something called peace. Oh, you, please forgive me, folks, but these socialists can be. You ever sit down and watch a 2-year-old kid play, and they just crack you up? You're just laughing every 5 minutes. Well, that's what happens when you watch socialists at work, too, because they are 2-year-old children. I got to read this again because my whole train of thought, everything, is just wiped out. The brochure says, quote, after the war will come something called peace, and it is equally the duty of every American to bear in mind that the fate of democracy and our own future will depend not alone on the outcome of the war, but on the outcome of that peace also.
Piece of cake.
I'm sorry, what did you say, Carolyn?
Piece of cake.
Piece of cake is right. Devil's food cake, as a matter of fact. Oh, boy. And you notice they use the word democracy. Socialists have never understood what a republic is. They've never referred to this nation as a republic. You see, the Soviet Union was a democracy. Cuba is a democracy. This is not a democracy. This is a republic. Dear socialists, a republic, mind you. Oh, boy. We'll depend upon the outcome of the peace. We need a peace aim, no less than a war aim, for victory.
And I need to step in here, ladies and gentlemen, and remind you all that Marx and Lenin both, that's Vladimir Lenin and Karl Marx, the fathers of socialism and communism, respectively, defined peace. Listen to me carefully. Lenin and Marx defined peace as the elimination of all opposition to socialism. Now, let me say that once again so that you get it really clear. They defined, Marx and Lenin both defined peace as the elimination of all opposition to socialism. And if you read your Bible, doesn't it say something about when everybody's crying, peace, peace, and there is no peace? I would admonish you to go back and read it one more time.
We helped to win the last war. We lost the peace. Now we are at the crossroads again. Why? Because you socialists won't keep your fingers out of everybody's business. That's why. Dummies. Unbelievable. Carolyn's cracking up so much she can't even breathe over here. We lost the peace. We didn't lose anything, folks. We didn't lose a thing. We didn't have any business in any, either one of those wars. Now we're at the crossroads again. Why? Do we, the free peoples of the earth, know where we expect to go? Have we a plan to attain an orderly, peaceful, prosperous world based on freedom? Up until now, the answer has been no. But there is an answer now. Federal union is such a belief. Federal union is a faith in an expanding democracy and in an expanding, embracing democratic way of life for the whole world. Now, translated, that means, folks, that we don't like the way you guys live in all the different countries in the world, and what we're going to do is we're going to snatch you up, slap down your sovereign boundaries, and we're going to force you to be a part of the United Nations, whether you want to be or not. We're going to force you to be free in our world democracy. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And we ain't having none of that Bill of Rights stuff, you Americans, you see. You know, we're going to take care of you. No matter who you are, what you do, whether you're hungry or not, we're going to feed you. And even if your diaper's clean, we're still going to change it. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. I wonder what it would be like if all the socialists had to live together in one spot. And there was nobody else there, just them. What would they do? What would they do, folks? I would love to see some kind of an experiment like that. I think it would be hilarious. The organ outlines a strong but flexible union composed of the English-speaking democracies to be open to other nations as they develop or restore democratic rights, whatever that means. It further proposes that the union would guarantee every citizen the individual rights set forth in our Bill of Rights, the rights of free men. Now, we know that that's false because in the United Nations there is no Bill of Rights. They have never attempted to create any Bill of Rights. And in all the charters and so-called proposed constitutions of the world federalists, there has never been any Bill of Rights, proposals for Bills of Rights, adoption of our Bill of Rights, nor any concern about individual freedoms whatsoever. It's all about the individual must suffer for the good of the whole. And even if we end up with a state that's supreme and only one human being on this earth, it will be better than the world is now. And the state will be supreme over that one human being. And we'll take care of that human being and feed him and change his diaper and give him a job.
And there'll be no aggression.
That's right. And if there is, the state will smack down that one lone left remaining human being. And then finally, the great socialist totalitarian state will reign supreme over all the world in all its lonely glory. And humanity will disappear from the face of the earth. Oh, I'm taking a little freedom here, folks. But you know what? We have to inject some humor into this sometimes. And I know that there's some socialist out there scratching his head saying, that's not funny.
Yeah. Well, what they give us isn't funny either.
That's right. We're fixing to give it all back to them. Only, you know what? I think every socialist in the world should be given an enema tomorrow at 6 a.m. I think that would give them a completely different outlook for the rest of the day anyway. What do you think, folks? Well, maybe I should get serious.
Each, let me see, where we get? Oh, here we go. Going to guarantee everybody everything. And it graciously suggests that it be abandoned for something better if something better can be found. I can't believe that. Here they're saying that what they propose is better than anything that there ever was, and it's got to be, and then they're saying, they suggest that it be abandoned for something better, if something better can be found. I didn't know that socialists recognized that there could be anything better. That's promising anyway. Not being a true world government plan, that is, not including all the nations of the world, this plan has been forced into oblivion by a larger and more aggressive group, the United World Federalists Incorporated, the main contenders in the world government arena of this country today. Now remember, that was in 1955, folks. Each prominent figures as former Senator Robert C. or G. Hendrickson of New Jersey shouted for world government, making an impassioned plea on the floor of the Senate in July 1949. He called for the ratification of the Atlantic Pact, eventual Atlantic Federal Union, and ultimate world government. Owen J. Roberts, retired Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Robert J. Patterson, former Secretary of War, Harold I. looks like Dick is, former Secretary of the Interior, Will L. Clayton, Joseph C. Grew, William Phillips, and Robert Woods Blass, all former Undersecretaries of State, were all officers of the aforementioned Atlantic Union Committee Incorporated. That side of the page, for folks on the left, I guess the page was bent a little bit in the copier, and it was very difficult to read, so I hope you understand why I was pausing in inappropriate places. This committee sponsored Senate Concurrent Resolution 4, House Concurrent Resolution 26, with the active support of 28 senators and 84 congressmen. The resolution stated that whereas federal union in this country had secured prosperity and abundance for Americans, the president be requested to invite the democracies which sponsored the North Atlantic Treaty to a convention to explore the possibilities of forming within the framework of the United Nations the principles of free federal union, the avowed end result of which was to establish an Atlantic federal union as a necessary first step toward ultimate world government. And they did it, folks, and it was called NATO. NATO. The same United Nations police force that's operating in Europe and Bosnia right this moment. Well, it is, once again, that time. We must go for a short break. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back after this very short pause.
People, I think it's time we stop this running around. This world is going too fast and we'd like to slow it down. Don't let them talk you into doing what you don't want to. Just learn to say no and learn how to refuse. Cause you don't owe nobody nothing except God above. Go out and go after the things in life you love. Don't try to force it if it ain't going smooth. The one person that you should never try to fool you. You can make it to the top, but only you'll know when to reach. And I am not just talking, cause I practice what I preach. Maybe you don't do all the things you're supposed to. Your boss gives you a job you hate, but you smile, that's the rule. You see yourself playing the game and it's rubbing you wrong. Oh, you don't know how much more you'll fix. How long can it go on? Well, you don't know nobody, nothing except God above. Go out and go after the things in life you love. Don't try to force it if it ain't going smooth. The one person that you should never try to fool is you. You can make it to the top, but only you'll know when to reach.
Remember, folks, socialists suck, and that's why socialism sucks. It's destructive. It takes away your dignity. It takes away everything. Remember how you felt as a kid? You felt like you weren't anybody. Couldn't wait to get out of the house and be free. Well, that was mild compared to socialism. Very, very, very mild. Well, we're going to go to the phones. You've heard it. Read it to you tonight. That was how NATO began. That was the first steps toward forming NATO, which was going to be one of the first steps, besides the United Nations, toward world government. It is, in fact, NATO. NATO did, in fact, unite the military forces, and through the military forces, the governments of Europe, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, preparing for world government. I'm going to bring your attention now to a book that I want you to get. Make sure you get this book. This book was published in 1939 and 1940 by H.G. Wells. 1939 and 1940 by H.G. Wells. Guess what the name of the book is, folks?
We are not going to the phones. You're not going to the phones. You're listening to reruns from 1994. Just think how smart you'd be today if you'd been listening to us in 1994. Our first broadcast was May the 4th, 1992. You see, a lot of you are just catching up. And some of you who have been listening all these years have forgotten all of this stuff. So, you know, pay attention. Not taking calls. Maybe tomorrow night. Maybe if we finish this series.
1939 and 1940 by H.G. Wells. The name of the book is... The New World Order. That's right. The New World Order. And I know that many of you out there thought that George Bush coined that phrase. Here's what it says on the fly leaf of the dust jacket. What will happen to Europe and to the whole world when the present war is ended? There will be a revolution. That's obvious, Mr. Wells says. Following a consideration of those factors which make it inevitable, he concludes that such a revolution must be along socialistic lines if civilization is to survive. But the new world order, which Mr. Wells suggests, must be a world socialism, scientifically planned and directed, with insistence upon law based on a restatement of the rights of man and complete freedom of speech, criticism, and publication. This can be attained, he is convinced, only if each one is equally certain that it can and each will work none now towards realizing it. And no sane man can make a better beginning in that direction than to read this book. The table of contents, ladies and gentlemen, chapter one is called The End of an Age. I bet you couldn't guess that after listening to my Mystery Babylon series. The End of an Age, which means it's the beginning of a new age. Remember, this was copyrighted in 1939 and 1940 by H.G. Wells before the war started. Before the war started. He says, what will happen to Europe and to the whole world when the present war is ended? Are you beginning to understand out there, sheeple? I hope so. Chapter 2, Open Conference. Chapter 3, Disruptive Forces. Chapter 4, Class War. Chapter 5, Unsated Youth. Bring anything to mind? Chapter 6, Socialism Unavoidable. Chapter 7, Federation. Chapter 8, The New Type of Revolution. Chapter 9, Politics for the Sane Man. Chapter 10, Declaration of the Rights of Man. Chapter 11, International Politics. Chapter 12, World Order in Being.
Oh, sometimes I wish they'd let me cuss on radio. Oh, boy, I could just cuss a blue streak over some of this stuff. Isn't it fun, folks? Okay, don't go away. We got a lot of things to talk about. You got a lot of numbers and report numbers and laws and executive orders and U.S. codes and congressional record references that you're going to need to write down, because you're all going to have to go and look this stuff up. And if you don't, then you'll never know whether I'm lying to you or not. And if you just go with it without checking it out, that means you cease to be their puppet on their string, and now you're my puppet on my string.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance, and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I deliver. Bad news on the doorstep, I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And then good old boys was drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.
Yes. Everybody write down Senate Report Number 93-549, 93rd Congress. First session, 1973. That's Senate Report Number 93-549, 93rd Congress, First Session, 1973. I'm going to say it one more time. Senate Report Number 93-549, 93rd Congress, First Session, 1973. The title is Summary of Emergency Power Statutes. It's the Summary of Emergency Power Statutes. It consists of 607 pages, ladies and gentlemen, which I think you will find most interesting. You see, the United States went bankrupt in 1933 and was declared so by President Roosevelt by Executive Orders Number 6073, 6102, 6111, and by Executive Order 6260 on March the 9th, 1933. Executive Order 6073, 6102, 6111, and by Executive Order 6260 on March 9th, 1933. Also see Senate Report 93-549, pages 187 and 594. Under the Trading with the Enemy Act. That's the Trading with the Enemy Act. Okay, 65th Congress. That's Trading with the Enemy Act, 65th Congress, Session 1. Chapters 105 and 106, October 6th, 1917. So, Trading with the Enemy Act, 65th Congress, Session 1. Chapters 105 and 106, October 6th, 1917. And as codified at 12, USCA 95A. That's 12, USCA 95A. On May 23rd, 1933, Congressman Lewis T. McFadden brought formal charges against the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank System, the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Secretary of the United States Treasury
for criminal acts. The petition for articles of impeachment was thereafter referred to the Judiciary Committee and has yet to be acted upon, and the traitors in Congress know about it and are sitting on it and have been sitting on it from that date until this. See the Congressional Record, pages 4055 and 4058. Congress confirmed the bankruptcy on June the 5th, 1933, and impaired the obligations and considerations of contracts through the joint resolution to suspend the gold standard and abrogate the gold clause, June 5, 1933. See House Joint Resolution 192, 73rd Congress, First Session. The several states of the Union pledged the faith and credit thereof to the aid of the national government and formed numerous socialist committees, such as the Council of State Governments, Social Security Administration, and many others.
And at that time, ladies and gentlemen, is when birth certificates were born. The Department of Human Resources, not the Department of Registration of the live birth of humans, who are also citizens of the several states, but the Department of Human Resources pledged that those human resources would be the instruments to pay back the debt of the bankrupt United States over the many years to come. And we've never done it. In fact, we've debased the currency and the lawful money of the United States to the point that we couldn't pay back anything if we wanted to. You see, money has to have intrinsic value. What you have in your pocket is worth nothing. If you don't believe that, lay a $1 Federal Reserve note on the table in front of you. Put a $5 bill beside it, a $10 bill beside that, a $20 bill beside that, a $50 bill beside that, and a $100 bill beside that, and I defy you to tell me the difference between any of them as to their intrinsic value. There isn't any. They're all worthless pieces of paper, and the value is in your brainwashed mind. Congratulations. You have just graduated to the next highest grade.
And these were to purportedly deal with the economic emergency. These organizations operated, ladies and gentlemen, on something that you thought just came about, but that's not true. Operated under the Declaration of Interdependence. The Declaration of Interdependence. of January the 22nd, 1937. And published some of their activities in the Book of the States. The 1937 edition of the Book of the States openly declared that the people engaged in such activities as the farming, husbandry industry had been reduced to mere feudal tenants on their land. Refer to the Book of the States, 1937, page 155. This, of course, was compounded by such activities as price fixing, wheat and grains, 7 U.S.C.A. 1332, quota regulations, 7 U.S.C.A. 1371, and livestock products, 7 U.S.C.A. 1903, which have been consistently below the costs of production. Interest on loans and inflation of the paper bills of credit, leaving the food producers and others in a state of peonage and involuntary servitude, constituting the taking of private property for the benefit and use of others without just compensation against the Constitution. Now, the Council of State Governments has now been absorbed into such things as the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, whose headquarters office is located at 676 North Street. It's 676 North St. Clair Street, Suite 1700, Chicago, Illinois, 60611. That's 676 North St. Clair Street, Suite 1700, Chicago, Illinois, 60611.
Now remember, folks, you're listening to information that was originally broadcast in January January of 1994. So be aware of that as you do your research. We have no idea if these addresses and phone numbers are still good today.
All being members of the bar and operating under a different constitution and bylaws, far distant from the depositories of the public records, has promulgated, lobbied for, passed, adjudicated, and ordered the implementation and execution of their purported uniform and model acts and pretended statutory provisions to help implement international treaties of the United States are where world uniformity would be desirable. See the 1990 and 1991 reference book, National Council of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, page 2. This is apparently what Robert Bork meant when he wrote, quote, "We are governed not by law or elected representatives, but by an unelected, unrepresentative, unaccountable committee of lawyers applying no will but their own," unquote. All, ladies and gentlemen, Freemasons. See The Tempting of America by Robert H. Bork, page 130. This association has been engaged in activities such as turning marriage licenses into international private law through its international liaisons, which meet at such places as the Hague Conferences. See the Handbook of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, 1966 edition, pages 156 and 157. On April 25, 1938, the Supreme Court overturned this standing precedent of the prior 150 years concerning common law in the federal government and said this, quote, "There is no federal common law, and Congress has no power to declare substantive rules of common law applicable in a state, whether they be local or general in their nature, be they commercial law or a part of the law of torts."
And if you read the Constitution, you will find direct reference to the common law in the Constitution for the United States of America. What this means is that they are openly acknowledging that the Constitution has literally been shredded and flushed down the nearest toilet.
See the case, Erie Railroad Company versus Tompkins, 304, United States, 64, 80, 82nd, L.Ed., 1188. The common law is the fountain source of substantive and remedial rights, if not our very liberties. For that, see Stephen A., Treatise on the Principles of Pleading, Stephen A., Treatise on the Principles of Pleading, Introduction, page 23, and Hemingway, History of Common Law Pleading as Evidence of the Growth of Individual Liberty and Power of the Courts, 5 Alabama Law Journal, 1 Swift versus Tyson, 16 Peters 1, 10 L. Ed. 865, The Constitution, Article 3, Section 2, and Amendments 7, 9, and 10.
You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. This is the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper.
You want some more homework? Told you, folks. This is treason, and it's all documented, and anybody can find it. The members and association of the bar thereafter formed committees, granted themselves special privileges, immunities, and franchises, and held meetings concerning the judicial procedures, and further, to amend laws to conform to a trend of judicial decisions, or to accomplish similar objectives, including hodgepodging the jurisdictions of law and equity together, which is known today as one form of action. See the Constitution and Bylaws, Article 3, Section 3.3c, 1990-91, reference book, Supra. See also Colorado Methods of Practice, or Western Publications, Volume 4, or West Publications, Volume 4, pages 2 and 3, for the author's comments. The enumerated, specific, and distinct jurisdictions established by the ordained Constitution in 1789, Article 3, Section 2, and under the Bill of Rights, 1791, Amendment 7, were further hodgepodged and fundamentally changed in 1982 to include admiralty jurisdiction, which was once again brought inland. Quote, this is the fundamental change necessary to effect unification of civil and admiralty procedure, just as the 1938 rules abolished the distinction between actions at law and suits in equity. This change would abolish the distinction between civil actions and suits in admiralty. Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, 1982 edition, page 17. Also see the Federalist Papers, number 83. The Declaration of Resolves of the First Continental Congress, October 14, 1774. The Declaration of Cause and Necessity of Taking Up Arms, July 6, 1775. The Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1776. Bennett versus Butterworth, 52, United States, 669. Well, maybe you better go get a glass of water. I need a drink of coffee. So, start feeling that little tickle in the back of my throat. Well, whatever that is that we all have, just seems to hang on. The United States, folks, thereafter entered the Second World War, during which time the League of Nations was reinstituted under pretense of the United Nations. Remember, it had already risen and died. Now it was resurrected under the pretense of the United Nations. For that, see 22 U.S.C.A. 287 et sequitur, and the Bank for International Settlements, reinstituted under pretense of the Bretton Woods Agreement. See 60 Statutes 1401 22 U.S.C.A. 286 et sequitur, as the International Monetary Fund. The Fund and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the Bank. So you now have the Fund and the Bank. The United States, as a corporate body politic, artificial, came out of World War II in worse economic shape than when it entered, and in 1950 declared bankruptcy and reorganization. The reorganization is located in Title V of United States Code, annotated. The explanation at the beginning of 5 U.S.C.A. is most informative reading. The Secretary of the Treasury was appointed as the receiver in bankruptcy. See Reorganization Plan number 26, 5 U.S.C.A. 903, Public Law 94-564. Legislative History, pages 59-67. The United States went down the road and periodically filed for further reorganization. Things and situations worsened, having done what they were commanded not to do. For that, see Madison's Notes, Constitutional Convention, August 16, 1787, and Federalist Papers, number 44, and in 1965 passed the Coinage Act of 1965, completely debasing the constitutional coin, gold and silver, in effect dollar. See 18 U.S.C.A. 331 and 332, U.S. versus Marigold, 50 U.S. 560, 13 L.Ed. 257. At the signing of the Coinage Act on July 23, 1965, Lyndon Baines Johnson stated in his press release that, quote, when I have signed this bill before me, we will have made the first fundamental change in our coinage in 173 years. The Coinage Act of 1965 supersedes the Act of 1792, and that act had the title, an act establishing a mint and regulating the coinage of the United States. Now I will sign this bill to make the first change in our coinage system since the 18th century. To those members of Congress who are here on this historic occasion, I want to assure you that in making this change from the 18th century, we have no idea of returning to it, unquote. Hmm.
Now, it's important, folks, to take cognizance of the fact that no constitutional amendment was ever obtained to fundamentally change, amend, abridge, or abolish the constitutional mandates, provisions, or prohibitions. But due to internal and external diversions surrounding the Vietnam War, etc., the usurpation and breach went basically unchallenged and unnoticed by the general public at large, who became a wealthy man's cannon fodder or cheap source of slave labor. Let me say that for you again. The usurpation and breach went basically unchallenged and unnoticed by the general public at large, that's you, who became a wealthy man's cannon fodder or cheap source of slave labor, that's you again. See Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, Chapter 1, Behold a Pale Horse, by William Cooper. Congress was clearly delegated the power and authority to regulate and maintain the true and inherent value of the coin within the scope and purview of Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 5 and 6, and Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the ordained Constitution of 1787, and further, under a corresponding duty and obligation to maintain said gold and silver coin and foreign coin at and within the necessary and proper equal weights and measures clause. See also the Bible, Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 13 through 16, Proverbs chapter 16, verse 11, and Public Law 97-289 and 96 Statutes 12-11. Those exercising the offices of the several states in equal measure knew such de facto transitions were unlawful and unauthorized, unconstitutional, but sanctioned, implemented, and enforced the complete debauchment and the resulting governmental, social, industrial, economic change in the de jure states and in the United States of America. See Public Law 94-564, Legislative History, page 5936 and 5945, 31 U.S.C.A. 314, 31 U.S.C.A. 321, 31 U.S.C.A. 5112, CRS 1161-101, CRS 3922-103.5, and CRS 1811-203, and were and are now under the delusion that they can do both directly and indirectly what they were absolutely prohibited from doing. See also the Federalist Papers, number 44, Craig versus Missouri, and 4 Peters, 903. In 1966, ladies and gentlemen, Congress began severely compromised, passed the Federal Tax Lien Act of 1966, by which the entire taxing and monetary system, in effect, the essential engine, see the Federalist Papers, number 31, and Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, Behold a Pale Horse, Chapter 1, and was placed under the Uniform Commercial Code. See Public Law 89-719, Legislative History, pages 3722. Also, see CRS 51106, the Uniform Commercial Code was, of course, promulgated by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in collusion with American Law Institute for the, quote, banking and business interests, unquote. See the Handbook of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, 1966 edition, pages 152 and 153. The United States, being engaged in numerous United Nations conflicts, including the Korean and the Vietnam conflicts, which were under direction of the United Nations, see 22 U.S.C.A. 287D, and agreeing to foot the bill, see 22 U.S.C.A. 287J, and not being able to honor their obligations, and rehypothecated debt credit openly and publicly, dishonored and disavowed their notes and obligations. 12 U.S.C.A. 411, in effect, Federal Reserve Notes
through Public Law 90-269, Section 2, 82 Statutes at Large 50, 1968, to wit. Quote, Section 2. The first sentence of Section 15 of the Federal Reserve Act, 12 U.S.C. 391, is amended by striking, quote, and the funds provided in this act for the redemption of Federal Reserve notes, unquote. Things steadily grew worse. And on March 28, 1970, President Nixon issued Proclamation Number 3972, declaring an emergency because the postal employees struck against the de facto government for higher pay due to inflation of the paper bills of credit. See Senate Report Number 93-549, page 596. Nixon then placed the United States Postal Department under control of the Department of Defense. See the Department of the Army Field Manual, FM 41-10, 1969 edition. The system had been faltering for a decade, but the benchmark date of the collapse is put at August 15, 1971. On this day, President Nixon reversed United States international monetary policy by officially declaring the non-convertibility of the United States dollar or Federal Reserve note into gold. See Public Law 94-564, Legislative History, page 5937, and Senate Report Number 93-549. Forward on page 3, my tongue is getting tied around my iTunes, folks. Let me say that again so that no one gets confused. See Public Law 94-564, Legislative History, page 5937, and Senate Report Number 93-549, forward, page 3, Proclamation Number 4074, page 597, 31 U.S.C.A. 314, and 31 U.S.C.A. 5112. See Public Law 94-564, Legislative History, page 5937, and Senate Report Number 93-549, forward, page 3, Proclamation Number 4074, page 597, 31 U.S.C.A. 314, and 31 U.S.C.A. 5112. On September 21, 1973, Congress passed Public Law 93-110, amending the Bretton Woods Par Value Modification Act, 82 Statutes 116, 31 U.S.C.A. 449, and reiterated the emergency under 12 U.S.C.A. 95A and Section 8 of the Bretton Woods Agreements Act of 1945, 22 U.S.C.A. 286F, and which included reports on foreign currency transactions. See also Executive Order Number 10033. This act further declared in Section 2B that, quote, no provision of any law, in effect, on the date of enactment of this act, and no rule, regulation, or order under authority of any such law may be construed to prohibit any person from purchasing, holding, selling, or otherwise dealing with gold. On January 19, 1976, Marjorie S. Holt noted for the record a second declaration of interdependence and clearly identified the United Nations as a communist organization, and that they were seeking both production and monetary control over the Union and people through international organization promoting the One World Order. See Congressional Record, January 19, 1976, Extension of Remarks. Also see 8 U.S.C.A. 1101, 40, 50 U.S.C.A. 781, and 783. The socio-economic situation, of course, worsened, as noted in the complaint petition filed in the U.S. Court of Claims, docket number 41-76, on February the 11th, 1976, by 44 federal judges, Atkins et al. Versus United States. Atkins et al. Complained that, quote, as a result of inflation, the compensation of federal judges has been substantially diminished each year since 1969, causing direct and continuing monetary harm to plaintiffs. The real value of the dollar decreased by approximately 34.5% from March 15, 1969 to October 1, 1975. As a result, plaintiffs have suffered an unconstitutional deprivation of earnings, unquote. And in the prayer for relief claimed, quote, damages for the constitutional violations enumerated above measured as the diminution of his earnings for the entire period since March 9, 1969, unquote. Now, you don't have to be too smart to know that it's quite apparent that the persons holding and enjoying offices of public trust and honor and our prophet knew of the emergent problem and sought protection for themselves to the damage and injury of the people and children who were classified as a, quote, club that has many other members, unquote, and, quote, have no remedy, unquote, and knowing that, quote, heinous, unquote, acts had been committed, stated that they, judges and lawyers, would not apply the law, nor would any substantive remedy be applied, or checked more or less, but never stopped, quote, until all of us judges are dead, unquote. Such persons fraudulently swore an oath to uphold, defend, and preserve the sovereignty of the nation and several Republican states of the Union, and breached the duty to protect the people, the citizens, and their posterity from fraud, imposition, avarice, and stealthy encroachment. See Atkins et al. Versus United States, 556 F2D, 1028, page 1072, 1074. See The Tempting of America, Supra, pages 155 through 159. Also see 5 U.S.C.A. 5305 and 5335. Senate Report Number 93-549, pages 69 through 71, CRS 24-75-101. This is verified in Public Law 94-564, the Legislative History, page 5944, which states, quote, moving to a floating exchange rate for international commerce means private enterprise and not central governments bear the risk of currency fluctuations. Unquote. That's us. Now, numerous serious debates were held in Congress, including but not limited to Tuesday, July 27, 1976. And you can see the congressional record for the House, July 27, 1976, concerning the International Financial Institutions and its operations. Representative Ron Paul, chairman of the House Banking Committee, made numerous references to the true practices of the, quote, international, unquote, financial institutions, including but not limited to the conversion of $27 million in gold contributed by the United States as part of its quota obligations, which the International Monetary Fund, Governor Secretary of the Treasury, now, you know what I'm saying here. The governor of the International Monetary Fund is the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States of America. He receives his paycheck from the International Monetary Fund and not from the United States government. Talk about treason. The International Monetary Fund sold this gold. They sold it. See Public Law 94-564. The legislative history on pages 5945 and 5946. And they sold it under some very questionable terms and concessions. You can also see the Ron Paul Money Book, 1991, by Ron Paul, Plantation Publishing, 837 West Plantation, Clute, Texas, 77531. That last number was the zip code, in case you're still enmeshed in all these USCAs and other things. On October 28, 1977, the passage of Public Law 95-147, 91 Statutes, 1227, declared most banking institutions, including state banks, to be under direction and control of the corporate governor of the International Monetary Fund. See Public Law 94-564. And let me read that again for you. On October 28, 1977, the passage of Public Law 95-147, 91 Statutes, 1227, declared most banking institutions, including state banks, to be under direction and control of the corporate governor of the International Monetary Fund. See Public Law 94-564, Legislative History, page 5942, United States Government Manual, 1990 and 91, pages 480 through 481, and the Act further declared that, quote, 2. Section 10A of the Gold Reserve Act of 1934, 31 U.S.C. 822A and B, is amended by striking out the phrase, quote, stabilizing the exchange value of the dollar, unquote, unquote. C. The joint resolution entitled Joint Resolution to Assure Uniform Value to the Coins and Currencies of the United States, approved June 5, 1933, 31 U.S.C. 463, shall not apply to obligations issued on or after the date of enactment of this section, unquote. The international organizations, corporations, and associations had refused to pay their debts and could not pay their debts, and determined that they could pass the loss of their non-redeemable, non-current notes, bonds, and evidences of debt off on others, and thereby crown their fraud with success. Wonder who those others are. You're going to find out. See a letter, October 26, 1989, from the Department of Treasury, Russell L. Monk, Assistant General Counsel, International Affairs, as recorded in the office of the Clerk and Recorder, Baca County, Colorado, at Book 540, page 364. The de facto United States as Corporator, 22 U.S.C.A. 286E et sequitur and State, CRS 2436104, CRS 2460-1301, Article 4H, had declared, quote, insolvency, unquote. See 26 IRC 165G 1, UCC 1-201, 23, CRS 3922-103.5, Westfall versus Braley, 10 Ohio 188 75, MDEC 509, Adams versus Richardson, 337, SW 2nd, or 2D, I should say, SW 2D, 911, Ward versus Smith, 7 Wall, 447. In 1980, Congress passed, among other things, Public Law 96-221, providing for the furtherance and expansion of the profligate rehypothecated debt pyramid scheme and reduced the reserve requirements on transaction accounts to a minimum of 3% per centum to a maximum of 14%. See Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, Section 103B(e)(2). Quote, in the United States, neither paper currency nor deposits have value as commodities. Intrinsically, a dollar bill is just a piece of paper. Deposits are merely book entries. Coins do have some intrinsic value as metal, but generally far less than their face amount. In the absence of legal reserve requirements, banks can build up deposits by increasing loans and investments, so long as they keep enough currency on hand to redeem whatever amounts the holders of deposits want to convert into currency. This unique attribute of the banking business was discovered several centuries ago. At one time, bankers were merely middlemen. They made profit by accepting gold and coins brought to them for safekeeping and lending them to borrowers, but they soon found that the receipts they issued to depositors were being used as money, since whoever held them could go to the banker and exchange them for metallic money. Then, bankers discovered that they could make loans merely by giving borrowers their promise to pay banknotes. That's what banknotes are, folks. In this way, banks began to create money. More notes could be issued than the gold and coin on hand because only a portion of the notes outstanding would be presented for payment at any one time. Enough metallic money had to be kept on hand, of course, to redeem whatever volume of notes was presented for payment. Transaction deposits are the modern counterpart of banknotes. It was a small step from printing notes to making book entries to the credit of borrowers, which the borrowers in turn could spend by writing checks, thereby printing their own money. See Modern Money Mechanics, a workbook on deposits, currency, and bank reserves, 1982. Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, Post Office Box 834, Chicago, Illinois, 60690, pages 3 and 4. What I just read you, ladies and gentlemen, is quoted verbatim from the Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, Section 103B(e)(2). Years is not temporary. It's a permanent state of emergency and was clearly instituted, formed, and erected within the Union through gross usurpations, abridgments, malfeasance, breach of legal duties, treason, and the continual contrivance, misrepresentation, conversion, fluctuations, fraud, lies, and avarice of the international financial institutions, organizations, corporations, and associations, and secret societies, including the Federal Reserve, their fiscal and depository agent, 22 U.S.C.A. 286D. This profligate practice has led to such emergency legislation as the Public Debt Limit Balance Budget and Emergency Deficit Control Act of 1985, Public Law 99-177, etc. The government, by becoming a corporator, see 22 U.S.C.A. 286E, lays down its sovereignty and takes on that of a private citizen. It can exercise no power which is not derived from the corporate charter. See the Bank of the United States versus Planters Bank of Georgia, 6 L. Ed. 9 Wheat, 244, United States versus Burr, 309 U.S. 242. The real party in interest is not the de jure United States of America or state, but, quote, the bank, unquote, and, quote, the fund, unquote. 22 U.S.C.A. 286 et sequitur, CRS 1160-103. The acts committed under fraud, force, and seizures are many times done under, quote, letters of marque and reprisal, unquote, in effect, recapture under the prize laws of admiralty. See 31 U.S.C.A. 5323, such principles as fraud and justice never, ever dwell, ladies and gentlemen, together. Wingate's Maxims 680, and quote, a right of action cannot arise out of fraud, unquote. Broome's Maxims 297 and 729. Cowper's Reports 343. 5 Scott's New Reports 558. 10 Massachusetts 276. 38 Fed 800 are too high of a thought concept, as is due process, just compensation, and justice itself. You see, honor is earned by honesty and integrity, not under false and fraudulent pretenses, nor will the color of the cloth one wears cover up the usurpations, lies, trickery, deceits, and treason. You see, when black is fraudulently declared to be white, not all will live in darkness. As astutely observed by Will Rogers, quote, there are men running governments who shouldn't be allowed to play with matches, unquote, and we learned that in Waco, Texas. And it is as applicable today as Jesus' statements about lawyers. The contrived emergency has created numerous abuses and usurpations and abridgments of delegated powers and authority, as stated in Senate Report 93-549. Quote, since March 9, 1933, the United States has been in a state of declared national emergency. In fact, there are now in effect 4 presidentially proclaimed states of national emergency, in addition to the national emergency declared by President Roosevelt in 1933. There are also the national emergency proclaimed by President Truman on December 16, 1950. That's December 16, 1950, during the Korean conflict. And the states of national emergency declared by President Nixon on March 23, 1970 and August 15, 1971. These proclamations give force to 470 provisions of federal law. These hundreds of statutes delegate to the President extraordinary powers, ordinarily exercised by the Congress, which affect the lives of American citizens in a host of all-encompassing manners. This vast range of powers taken together confer enough authority to rule the country without reference to constitutional process. Under the powers delegated by these statutes, the President may seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law, seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate the operation of private enterprise, restrict travel, and in a plethora of particular ways, control the lives of every American citizen. The introduction of that Senate report on page 1 begins with a phenomenal declaration, to wit, quote, a majority of the people of the United States have lived all of their lives under emergency rule. For 40 years, freedoms and governmental procedures guaranteed by the Constitution have in varying degrees been abridged by laws brought into force by states of national emergency.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard.
Tonight's episode of The Hour of the Time is produced and directed by Pooh, who's here in the studio with us, overseeing everything. And, of course, singing right along with the lyrics. She's my brown-eyed girl. Yes, sir. Tonight, 83rd Congress, second session. United States Senate document number 87. 83rd Congress, second session. United States Senate document number 87. A review of the United Nations Charter, a collection of documents, subcommittee of the United Nations Charter, pursuant to Senate Resolution 126, 83rd Congress, first session, presented by Mr. Wiley, January 7, 1954, ordered to be printed with illustrations, United States Government Printing Office, Washington, 1954. I'll be reading selected excerpts. And we're going to start off here with Section 36, Act prescribing the position of the United States flag to the United States. Let me start that over again, folks. Act prescribing the position of the United Nations flag to the United States flag, July 9, 1953. An act to prohibit the display of flags of international organizations or other nations in equal or superior prominence or honor to the flag of the United States, and catch this, folks, except under specified circumstances and for other purposes. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled that Section 3C of the Joint Resolution entitled Joint Resolution to Codify and Emphasize Existing Rules and Customs Pertaining to the Display and Use of the Flag of the United States of America, approved June 22, 1942, as amended 36 United States Code Section 175C, is amended by adding at the end thereof the following new sentence. Quote, no person shall display the flag of the United Nations or any other national or international flag equal, above, or in a position of superior prominence or honor to, or in place of, the flag of the United States at any place within the United States or any territory or possession thereof, provided that nothing in this section shall make unlawful the continuance of the practice heretofore followed of displaying the flag of the United Nations in a position of superior prominence or honor and other national flags in positions of equal prominence or honor with that of the flag of the United States at the headquarters of the United Nations, approved July 9, 1953. Treaties and domestic law. View of the four sponsoring... I want to make a point on that, folks, that the United Nations flag is flown at the United Nations headquarters above the flag of the United States, and it is United States soil. Treaties and domestic law. View of the four sponsoring governments. Abstract of statement by Honorable John Foster Dulles, United States Delegation on Domestic Jurisdiction, Clause of the Charter, San Francisco Conference, 1945. In his exposition of the intent of Article 8, Mr. Dulles emphasized that the four-power amendment dealt with domestic jurisdiction as a basic principle, and not, has been the case, in the original Dumbarton-Oaks proposals and in Article 15 of the Covenant of the League of Nations, as a technical and legalistic formula designed to deal with the settlement of disputes by the Security Council. This change in concept had been caused, he explained, by the change in the character of the organization as planned in the discussions at San Francisco. The scope of the organization was now broadened to include functions which would enable the organization to eradicate the underlying causes of war, as well as to deal with crises leading to war. Under the Social and Economic Council, the organization would deal with economic and social problems. This broadening of the scope of the organization constituted a great advance, but it also engendered special problems. For instance, the question had been raised as to what would be the basic relation of the organization to member states. Would the organization deal with the governments of the member states, or would the organization penetrate directly into the domestic life and social economy of the member states? as provided in the amendment of the sponsoring governments, Mr. Dulles pointed out that this principle would require the organization to deal with the governments. Under the Economic and Social Council, the organization had a mandate to raise the standards of living and foster employment, etc. But no one in the 10-member council would go behind the governments in order to impose its desires. The amendment recognized the distinct value of the individual social life of each state. In reply to the contention that domestic jurisdiction should be determined in accordance with international law, Mr. Dulles again pointed out that international law was subject to constant change and therefore escaped definition. It would, in any case, be difficult to define whether or not a given situation came within the domestic jurisdiction of a state. Interesting. In summary, Mr. Dulles stressed the virtues of the principle, its breadth, and its simplicity. The organization, in none of its branches or organs, should intervene in what was essentially the domestic life of the member states. Moreover, this principle was subject to evolution. In other words, what he just said didn't mean anything. The United States had had long experience in dealing with a parallel problem, in effect, the relationship between the 48 states and the federal government. Today, the federal government of the United States exercised an authority undreamed of when the Constitution was formed, and the people of the United States were grateful for the simple conceptions contained in their Constitution. And we still are, folks. We'd like to have it back. In like manner, Mr. Dulles foresaw that if the Charter contained simple and broad principles, future generations would be thankful to the men at San Francisco who had drafted it. Thank you very much, Mr. Alger Hiss, you commie devil, you rat, you dirty, dirty rat, and all the rest of you. Oh, boy, all but one of those who had a hand in drafting the United Nations Charter, ladies and gentlemen, were eventually named as communists, and many of them were imprisoned. The chairman moved a vote of thanks to Mr. Dulles for his masterly exposition of the problem of domestic jurisdiction, and Mr. Evatt rose to second the motion. Now we go to Section 69, Se Fuji'i and the State of California. Opinion of the District Court of Appeals, 2nd District, Division 2, California, April 24, 1950. In the period of 30 years since the Alien Land Law was adopted, we have revised our opinions concerning the rights of other peoples. Out of the travail of World War II came the concept of respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion, as expressed in the Charter of the United Nations, 59 Statutes, 1035 FF, U.S. Code, Congressional Service, 79th Congress, 1945, page 964. The government of the United States has traditionally been the leader in espousing the rights of man and has championed the cause of the smaller and less privileged nations. The War of 1898 was fought in support of an oppressed country. The efforts of our government in this regard reached fruition in the Convention of Representatives of the Nations of the Earth, at which the Charter of the United Nations was adopted. It was promptly ratified by the Senate of the United States, thereby proclaiming allegiance to its principles and providing precedent and example for other countries. The United States has consistently regarded its treaties with other nations as inviolate. The Charter has become, quote, the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding, unquote. Now, for all you sheeple out there who don't understand what I just read, I'm going to read it again. And all you bleeding liberals out there who claim allegiance to the Constitution but support this treason, you better listen very closely. You cannot have two masters. The Charter has become, quote, the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding, unquote. The United States Constitution, Article 6, Section 2, the position of this country in the family of nations, forbids trafficking in nocious generalities, but demands that every state in the Union accept and act upon the Charter according to its plain language and its unmistakable purpose and intent. And there you have it, folks. An admission by the United States Senate that the United Nations Charter is the supreme law of the land. Now, those of you who have been so obnoxious as to call me a liar, I expect to have a written apology within 5 days. Thank you very much. Since the Charter is now the supreme law of the land, it becomes necessary to examine its provisions and guarantees and to interpret it in the light in which it was adopted by the participating nations. The organization determined in the preamble, quote, to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights and the dignity and worth of the human person, to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. There is no larger freedom, ladies and gentlemen, than what we have possessed in this country. What they are talking about is democratic socialism. In other words, what the Nazis had in Germany in World War II. Social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. Once you understand the socialist code words, it begins to make better sense to you. Remember, socialism and socialists suck. Can't put it any better than that. They're all out there somewhere sucking right this moment. Among the purposes and principles found in Article 1 of Chapter 1 are, quote, to develop friendly relations among nations based on respect for the principle of equal rights, to achieve international cooperation in promoting and encouraging respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion, unquote. Now notice what they say, folks. Our forefathers said all men are created equal. Created equal. That means when they're born, they have the same opportunities as anyone else. What they do with their life, however, is quite a different story. In other words, when all of a generation reach the age of 20 years old, they are not equal. Some have demonstrated that they are superior, some remain average, and some become a burden upon everyone else and are, without a doubt, inferior. But socialists say this. Socialists, folks, say this. Listen carefully. To develop friendly relations among nations based on respect for the principle of equal rights, which means everyone is equal all the time. It just ain't so, ladies and gentlemen. Never has been and never will be. No one will ever have any respect for the person who makes welfare a career, who has children just for the sake of more money in their welfare check. No one will ever have any respect for a man, who sits on the street corner claiming that there are no jobs when you can open any newspaper and find pages and pages of jobs available for those who would have them. For people who, when they need work, will not accept the work that may be available until they can find better work because, quote, it's beneath my dignity, unquote. If you're that kind of person, you have no dignity. You have no honor, no ethics. In Article 2, it is affirmed that the organization and its members, quote, shall fulfill in good faith the obligations assumed by them in accordance with the present charter, unquote. It is agreed in Chapter 9, Article 55, that the United Nations shall promote universal respect for and observance of human rights and fundamental freedoms for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion. By Article 56, it is declared that all members pledge themselves to take joint and separate action in cooperation with the organization for the achievement of the purposes set forth in Article 55. In the address of the President of the United States to the Senate on July 2, 1945, urging the prompt ratification of the Charter by that body, he said, quote, "It seeks to promote worldwide progress and better standards of living. It seeks to achieve universal respect for and observance of human rights and fundamental freedoms for all men and women without distinction as to race, language, or religion. It seeks to remove the economic and social causes of international conflict and unrest. It is the product of many hands and many influences. It comes from the reality of experience in a world where one generation has failed twice to keep the peace. The lessons of that experience have been written into the document," unquote. United States Code, Congressional Service, Supra, pages 961 through 962. They don't tell you that they're the ones who caused those wars in order to bring this about. And that is well documented also. On December 10, 1948, the General Assembly of the United Nations passed and proclaimed and called upon all member countries to publicize, disseminate, and expound in schools and elsewhere a, quote, "Universal Declaration of Human Rights," unquote. And you all thought it was something new, didn't you? None of this is new, folks. None of it. Affirming, among other things, that, quote, "all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They should act toward one another in a spirit of brotherhood." I agree with that, folks, as long as it stops with being born free and equal in dignity and rights. Many people give up their freedom voluntarily, and no one beyond that point is equal in the truest sense with anyone else.
And that wraps it up for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you've learned something. I hope that you're angry. I hope that you understand what we're losing. And I hope that you're beginning to form some kind of an idea of what must be done in order to save it. Good night. And God bless each and every single one of you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like more information on what you've been hearing on this broadcast and current events, go to our website, harvest-trust.org. That's harvest-trust.org. Once again, harvest, H-A-R-V-E-S-T.
V as in Victor, EST, dash, with no space, trust, TRUST, dot, ORG. That's harvest-trust.org. You'll be amazed at what you find there. In fact, you can spend weeks on our website and never, ever see everything. The Hour of the Time is a presentation of Harvest Trust. We would like to thank the Independence Foundation for the kind use of their studios.